Good morning. It's Monday, May 25th, and this is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, protests in Hong Kong after China attempts to impose new laws.
There is complete mistrust. There's complete disgust and hatred for Hong Kong's police force.
Plus, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu goes on trial for corruption. And Muslims around the world celebrate the end of Ramadan amid COVID-19. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is COVID-19. The world's worst outbreak is in the U.S., where there have been 1.6 million reported cases and almost 100,000 deaths. Even so, the country is beginning to open back up. Americans flocked to beaches and outdoor areas this weekend to celebrate the annual Memorial Day holiday, while President Donald Trump played golf for the first time since the pandemic began. The White House on Sunday said it was prohibiting most non-U.S. citizens from traveling to the United States if they had been in Brazil in the last 2 weeks, 2 days after the South American nation became the world number two hotspot for coronavirus cases. Brazil has nearly 350,000 reported cases and over 22,000 deaths. Russia is the third worst-hit nation. Chile's president, Sebastian Piñera, said Sunday that his country's healthcare system is under strain and, quote, very close to the limit, end quote, as the number of confirmed COVID-19 infections approaches 70,000 after a rapid increase in recent days. In India, domestic flights will resume Monday, even though the number of new cases rose by nearly 7,000 on Sunday to 131,000, the largest single daily increase so far in the South Asian nation. But elsewhere in the world, the virus is showing signs of retreat. The public returned to St. Peter's Square in the Vatican on Sunday to receive Pope Francis's blessing from his window for the first time in nearly 3 months. But only a few dozen people went to the square. They kept to social distancing rules and most wore masks. And France reported the smallest daily rise in new coronavirus cases and deaths on Sunday since before a lockdown began on March 17th, raising hopes that the worst of the epidemic is over in France. And Australia has had over 7,000 COVID-19 cases with over 100 deaths. But in the last week, Australia has averaged just 10 new cases per day, a significant decline after reporting nearly 500 new cases in a single day less than 2 months ago. Now, the country is relaxing its COVID-19 controls. Australia's most populous state of New South Wales will allow bars, cafes, and restaurants to serve up to 50 people at a time starting June 1st. But strict hygiene rules will still apply. For more on Australia's reopening, journalist Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Gradually, life in Australia is coming to resemble what it was before COVID-19. In just over a week's time, up to 50 people will be allowed into bars, cafes and restaurants in Sydney, the biggest city in the country. It's not a return to normal just yet, though. Each person must have at least 4 square meters of space. Patrons won't be permitted to stand, mingle or dance. Currently, venues are allowed to host up to 10 diners. Authorities in New South Wales say a further relaxation of the regulations on June 1 is a big step in the state's economic recovery from the new coronavirus. State Premier Gladys Berejiklian.
This will be with very strict guidelines in place. It has to be in adherence to the 4 square metre rule. So some venues are small in space. They will only be able to have as many customers as is allowed in that space according to the 4 square metre rule. And nobody will be able to take bookings of more than 10 people. Nobody will be able to be standing up in these venues. You have to be seated at a table, even if it's a pub.
Other states and territories in Australia's federated system have different approaches to winding back lockdown restrictions. In South Australia, pubs can serve food to up to 20 diners, 10 insides and 10 more outsides. In the state of Victoria, authorities are taking a phased approach to reopening the hospitality industry. By mid-July, up to 100 people are to be permitted to eat at a cafe or restaurant. In Western Australia, public swimming pools, libraries and places of worship can reopen under strict distancing and hygiene regulations. Easing disease controls will boost the Australian economy, which is facing its biggest contraction ever because of the COVID-19 crisis. An administrative bungle has forced the federal government to revise a historic economic rescue package announced in March. Officials had said mammoth wage subsidies would keep 6.5 million Australians in work during lockdowns. They now say mistakes in applications from businesses mean the scheme will now cover 3.5 million workers, cutting the cost from $85 billion to $45 billion. Opposition Labor leader Anthony Albanese says it's an embarrassing error.
This is a mistake you could have seen from space. And this is a government that couldn't run a bath. How about someone in this government accept responsibility just once?
Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Muslims around the world began the three-day Eid al-Fitr celebration over the weekend, marking the end of the holy month of Ramadan. But this year's Eid is like no other, thanks to the coronavirus. For more, VOA's Ayan Bior filed this report.
In the old city of Mosul in Iraq, an imam prays alone in a mosque.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
Despite the Eid holidays, the streets are mostly empty, a sign of the coronavirus that has left almost no corner of the world untouched. Maisir al-Shekhawi, a Mosul resident, led a small gathering of prayers in his neighborhood. He says, our wish for Eid is that Almighty God will remove this pandemic and disease so we can go back to our mosque and pray in the five prayers and Eid prayer, and joy and happiness can be back on people's face. In Saudi Arabia's Mecca, the Grand Mosque was also almost completely empty as authorities imposed unprecedented restrictions on gatherings due to the coronavirus. Only a small number of worshippers, many wearing masks, attended prayers at Islam's holiest site. Saudi officials said mosques would remain closed throughout the kingdom during the Eid festival and urged Muslims to hold their prayers at home. In Jerusalem, the famous Al-Aqsa Mosque was also closed. Small scuffles broke out between Israeli security forces and faithful who gathered around the mosque at dawn. Worshippers eventually prayed outside the building. Among them was Ishmat Shahoudi.
In 2017, it was the last time that the Al-Aqsa closed. But now it's a different feeling because Ramadan usually is used to be full of prayer from all around the world, even from outside the country and even from the West Bank and little bit people from Gaza.
Meanwhile, in Somalia, Eid celebrations took place in some areas but were marred by violence. At least four civilians, including children, were killed, and more than 15 others injured in a Sunday bomb blast in the southern town of Badoa. The explosion occurred as people performed traditional dances in a field near a displaced persons camp north of the town. Earlier on Sunday, a police general survived a roadside explosion targeting his vehicle, killing one of his bodyguards. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for either attack. But in Afghanistan, there was an Eid surprise. The Taliban insurgency announced a temporary ceasefire for the three-day Eid festival starting Sunday. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani responded to the unexpected ceasefire by ordering government forces to observe their own truce during the festivities. The surprise ceasefire came as weeks of fighting between Taliban and government security forces have killed and injured hundreds of people across the war-torn country. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he will not fire his chief aide for allegedly violating the national coronavirus lockdown rules that he helped to create. The advisor, Dominic Cummings, traveled 250 miles or 400 kilometers to his parents' home with his wife and son as he was coming down with COVID-19 at the end of March. Britain's lockdown, which began March 23rd, stipulated that people should remain at their primary residence and not visit relatives. One conservative lawmaker accused Cummings of, quote, believing the rules don't apply to him, end quote. And Russian fighters in Libya were flown out of a town south of Tripoli by their Libyan allies after retreating from front lines at the capital, the town's mayor said. The reported departure of the Russians is another blow to the Libyan National Army of General Khalifa Haftar and his foreign allies. Haftar's forces, backed by Russia, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates, have been trying to capture the capital for 13 months, but suffered a string of defeats in recent weeks in fighting against Turkey-backed forces of the Tripoli government. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. This is International Edition on the Voice of America. Hong Kong police fired tear gas and water cannon to disperse thousands of protesters demonstrating Sunday against Beijing's plan to directly impose national security laws on the city. The demonstrations come amid concerns over the fate of the one country, two systems formula that has governed Hong Kong since the former British colony's return to Chinese rule in 1997. The arrangement guarantees the city broad freedoms not seen on the mainland, including a free press and independent judiciary. Journalist Ria Mogul is in Hong Kong covering the unrest and spoke to International Edition's Steve Miller about what she saw.
Protesters gathered in Causeway Bay, which is probably one of the busiest districts in Hong Kong, to protest against the national security law, which Beijing announced on Thursday evening and would be implemented in the coming weeks. And police fired multiple rounds of tear gas, used pepper spray, used a water cannon to disperse protesters. And there were a few skirmishes as well between the pro-democracy protesters and also people, you know, from the pro-Beijing and pro-China camp. 120 people were arrested.
Ria, can you kind of walk us through Causeway Bay and the impact the protests were having there?
Protesters occupied several major thoroughfares in Hong Kong, vandalized some shops as well, which allegedly have some pro-Beijing ties to them. And now bear in mind, Causeway Bay is one of the busiest districts in Hong Kong. There's lots of shopping malls, restaurants, very, very high dense foot traffic. So there were protesters as well as just regular people that were going about their Sunday, you know, shopping, having lunch. And they too were met with the tear gas and the pepper spray and the water cannon as well. There is complete mistrust. There's complete disgust and hatred for Hong Kong's police force. At the minute, it's kind of hard to distinguish between who is a protester and who's just a regular pedestrian because everyone's wearing a face mask. We're still under COVID-19 restrictions. But even people that weren't necessarily doing the vandalizing or blocking roads were still heckling the police and shouting abuse and shouting slogans of freedom, you know, like a revolution of our times.
Ria, can you kind of explain why some protesters are saying that this is the de facto end of one country, two systems? And then also expand upon why the government feels that this is the appropriate call of action, even though governments around the world, including the United States, are saying that Beijing should not encroach on the freedoms of Hong Kongers.
This law that was announced on Thursday would actually bypass the city's legislature completely. And that has angered a lot of activists, a lot of Hong Kong people. They see it as a complete erosion of their rights. And that's one of the biggest reasons, actually, that they see one country, two systems being taken away. And the reason Beijing is coming down so hard on Hong Kong is, of course, last year's anti-government movement lasted for more than 7 months, only coming to a halt because of the spread of the coronavirus. Week after week, we saw hundreds of thousands of protesters take to the streets. So there's just a lot of anger on the pro-democracy side, and there's coming down even harder from Beijing because of this.
Ria, can you kind of provide some examples of some of the concerns, some of the fears that those in Hong Kong have should one country, two systems go away?
it could be that in a few weeks' time, them chanting these slogans of freedom and singing their protest anthems could be illegal. And, you know, what does it mean for journalists? And what does this mean for education? People are very concerned about what they're going to learn in schools and what their kids are going to learn in schools. People are just scared. There's a lot of frustration. There's a lot of uncertainty. But we do know that it is going to stop, or it is going to curb a lot of the freedoms that people in Hong Kong currently enjoy. In fact, today's demonstrations was also called to protest against a bill that would criminalize abuse of the Chinese national anthem in Hong Kong. If passed, could be punishable by a jail term of up to 3 years for someone if they say anything against the Chinese national anthem.
That was journalist Ria Mogul in Hong Kong speaking to my colleague Steve Miller in Washington. Myanmar submitted its first report to the International Court of Justice over the weekend in compliance with a court order earlier this year regarding accusations that Myanmar's army committed genocide against the country's Muslim Rohingya minority in 2017. Myanmar's government has denied the accusations. Ahead of the submission of the report, Myanmar military spokesman Brigadier General Zaw Min Tun told the press that the military has been cooperating with the government's report, as well as with a government-led effort to investigate and court-martial any members of the security forces who committed crimes. For more on the significance of Myanmar's report to the international court, I spoke earlier with Simon Adams, who is the executive director of the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect in New York.
This is a historic case. The fact that it's been taken forward by the Gambia and the fact that the court issued provisional measures. And I think there was a big question of whether Myanmar would actually respond to those provisional measures, even though it's legally obligated to do so, in a forthright way. Now, they've sent forward their report. We don't know exactly what is in that report, but we do know that it's linked to the three presidential directives which were issued in April, and which basically said that the authorities in Myanmar should stop any acts that might be genocidal and should not destroy any evidence of genocidal acts. I think that Myanmar's response is sort of superficial at best and deeply flawed at worst, but at least it was something.
Myanmar itself doesn't acknowledge that a genocide took place and barely acknowledges most of the crimes that its military is accused of.
Absolutely. I mean, the Rohingya are literally one of the most persecuted people in the world. The regime has denied the genocide ever since it's taken place, denies that there's a situation of ongoing persecution and discrimination. And so the fact that they felt compelled to respond is a very positive thing. But we've still got a long way to go. Those discriminatory laws and policies are still in place. There's still 1 million Rohingya refugees sheltering in nearby Bangladesh who want to come home. And the situation for the remaining Rohingya, who are partly segregated and are absolutely deprived of their rights, has not changed.
Now, regarding the International Court of Justice's order, there were a few different things that they ordered Myanmar to do. One of them, of course, was to file this report. But others, as you mentioned, were to stop any potentially genocidal actions against the Rohingya, to preserve, as you said, any evidence about crimes that have taken place. From your view, has Myanmar complied with those directives?
No, they haven't. I mean, what we know is that after the so-called clearance operations, basically the genocide took place in late 2017, the Myanmar authorities went out of their way to systematically destroy evidence, bulldozing Rohingya villages, destroying any kind of evidence of those crimes. So it's a little bit very much too little too late to say, please don't destroy evidence. And then, as I said, there's the much bigger issue of the ongoing situation of discrimination that those Rohingya who remain inside the country face, and that those in the refugee camps who are waiting to come home are sort of marooned now with the Myanmar authorities saying, come back, but the situation on the ground absolutely not having changed at all, and the threat of further atrocities, including genocide, being very real and being immediate.
What are the next steps for this case at the court.
So this is not the last time that Myanmar will have to report on the situation. They will now have to put in another report in 6 months' time, and they will have to continue to put in those reports every 6 months until this case is concluded. This case is going to go on for quite a while, but the evidence that they committed genocide is overwhelming, and it's very hard to see how they're going to be able to defend themselves from that charge.
That was Simon Adams, Executive Director for the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's corruption trial began this weekend. VOA's Linda Gradstein filed this report from Jerusalem.
Benjamin Netanyahu had already made history as the longest-serving prime minister in Israel's history. Sunday, he did it again, becoming the first sitting prime minister to go on trial for fraud and breach of trust. He arrived at the court from a cabinet meeting of his new national unity government. Outside the prime minister's house, hundreds of Israelis demonstrated against Netanyahu, calling on him to resign. Outside the courthouse in East Jerusalem, a similar number rallied for Netanyahu. Before entering the courtroom, Netanyahu lashed out against the court and the media, insisting that he is innocent of all charges. He said the trial is an attempt at a political coup against the will of the people. He said he will continue to fight and continue to lead the state of Israel. Netanyahu entered the small courtroom that seats about 20 people with two of his lawyers and refused to sit on the defendant's bench until photographers had been removed from the courtroom. The judges then read the charges against him, including fraud and breach of trust. Netanyahu is accused of performing favors in exchange for both gifts totaling hundreds of thousands of dollars and positive press coverage. His attorney said they needed several more months to study all of the materials, a request the prosecution said was unnecessary as the indictment was filed over a year ago. The trial is expected to take at least a year. In the new government formed earlier this month, Netanyahu is supposed to serve as prime minister for a year and a half before turning the job over to his former rival and head of a centrist party, Benny Gantz. A few months later, Israeli President Reuven Rivlin is due to retire. The president is a mostly ceremonial, although prestigious, job in Israel. It also confers immunity from prosecution. Many in Israel believe that Netanyahu is already competing for this job. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Greece has lodged a protest over Turkish troops' occupation of a small patch of swampland along the land border between the two NATO states. Nevertheless, dozens of Turkish soldiers and police remain planted there, defying demands that they retreat. For VOA, Amfi Karasava reports on the escalating tension between the two age-old rivals.
For more than 100 miles, the Evros River rips down through Greece's northeast frontiers, separating the country from age-old rival Turkey. About halfway down its course, the waterway swerves in and out of Turkey, creating a plain of small marsh. While officials call the area Melisokomio, locals such as Athanasios Pemousis commonly refer to it as the horseshoe because of its shape. He says the area is usually flooded in winter, but it is used by smugglers during the summer to sneak refugees into Greece. In recent days, though, he says, he and others have seen some 35 Turkish soldiers occupying the land, setting up a tent and flying a tiny Turkish flag from a tree. It may be swampland, he says, but it is Greek territory. The Foreign Affairs Ministry in Athens has lodged a stiff protest with Ankara, demanding the Turkish soldiers pull back from the region. It is refusing to comply, though, and that has Greece's Defense Minister Nikos Panagiotopoulos extremely concerned. Rising tensions, especially in small areas, he says, heighten the risk of an accident occurring, a spark that could inflame already uneasy ties between Greece and Turkey. Struggling to revive its devastated tourism industry, Greece has opted to keep the matter quiet, refusing to disclose whether it plans to evict the Turkish soldiers. While both NATO allies, Greece and Turkey, have been at odds with each other for decades, contesting each other's claims to air, land, and sea rights. 25 years ago, the two sides came to the brink of war over competing claims to a barren outcrop, inhabited only by goats, rabbits, and sheep. U.S. diplomacy helped pull back both allies from the brink. Defense experts tell VOA Turkey's decision to send troops to the region was probably sparked by Greek plans and ongoing technical surveys to extend its border fence with Turkey. Turkey refuses to acknowledge that some of the land on the eastern side of the Evros River still belongs to Greece. In recent weeks alone, Greek soldiers have been shot at four times from over the border, and Turkish fighter jets are routinely chased out of Greek airspace. The latest border incident comes weeks after tens of thousands of migrants tried to push their way into Greece from Turkey, after President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said in February that he would no longer prevent them from doing so. He has since then rescinded his decision in order to contain the spread of the COVID-19 pandemic. But he has vowed to allow refugees to enter Europe anew once the coronavirus pandemic subsides. Anthi Karasava for VOA News, Athens, Greece.
That's it for our show today. Thanks to our producer, Jackson Mvungani, and our entire team. And thank you for listening to The Voice of America. But before we go, here's a song to get your week started. It's called Corona Stay Fresh, featuring Kenyan artists Nelmo Nusong, Love E. Mgenge, Eleanor, and Lida. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.
Tena corona imetutisha imefanya dunia jela but social media tupotezana mathela it's time to tuelimishane let's learn to prevent that good hygiene na mkono kosha kwa sana zuia mkono kwa macho mapua mdomo na uso hii ni janga la dunia tuzuie jumuia kwa usafiri sanitize wacha tukoe dunia na vyo naongea na nani naongea na wewe nani tushare the right information tukoleane nani ukiona una dalili homa imezidi kwa sana na joto jingi mwilini shida kupumua na ujui shida ni nini call emergency number upate kipimo kamili na kama imekuadhiri sio mwisho wa maisha hiyo nazidi kuamini this life after corona hiyo na amini mimi. We stand as one God over everything. Usi judge anyone, anywhere, shafika. Please, we need it all for our mama na wazee. Vijana na watoto hapa kwetu. Tunakazana, tena sana, hapa kwetu.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. It's just no way you're going to get all these skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you don't have school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.